Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome. I'm Dr. Deborah.
Hi, I'm Coach Kelly.
And Coach Kelly, you look so cute in your workout clothes today.
This is why I love you. I called Dr. Deborah before I came. I'm like, I'm just going to warn you, I'm a sweaty pig right now in my workout clothes. And I'm like, and she's like, oh, I bet you look great. And you're so sweet
you
and complimentary.
Do. You do. And it's so much fun. Now we are Fitbit buddies.
Yes. We got the Fitbit, for those of you who don't know what it is, because I just kind of, I'm new to this too. And it's like, it's, you know, it measures your steps and things like that. But there's this whole community online where you can basically have competitions with your friends. And I'm so competitive and Deborah keeps beating me. So like, we're going to have a serious like walkathon here between the two of us.
I've never been asked before about how many steps I take in a day and how do I get those? And what are you doing? And how do I get this? So
I literally
cute.
Like grilled her today. I'm like, what are you doing? What's your secret? Like, come on. So funny.
Because I walk and talk while I'm taking my power walk. So right. I'll dictate a blog or I'll dictate ideas for a blog
so
or things
smart.
Like that. So I'm kind of double tasking, yes, at the same time. But I'm dying to hear how is your fun with your family?
Okay, so my parents came in. We had such an amazing time. My parents stayed with the kids one night while I went to San Diego with my husband. And we had such a great night. They bring up the kids the next day. That was fine. Everything's great. And then my son, my younger one, we go to SeaWorld. He has like diarrhea everywhere and their mother. Okay. So it was just one of like the bodily fluids in my household. Like I can't even
describe. You can't catch a break. Oh my
gosh. So it was everywhere. Oh. So we dealt with it. It was fine. You know, I brought some extra clothes and all that. But then a friend of mine called me. She lives in San Diego. She's like, oh, come over. I'm like, great. I'm like, listen, I got to warn you. My son had diarrhea. Is it okay? Because she's got kids. You know, I just want to be open. And she's like, yeah, no problem. She's really relaxed. Thank God. So we come to her house and Lennon's like, my tummy hurt.
Oh, no.
Everywhere in their mother throws up. My phobia
yes, your
vomit.
Version to throw
yes.
up. Yes.
And I'm just standing there paralyzed. And like David is even like, I don't even know what to do. I'm like, move him, put him, take him in the shower. Like I didn't.
So he's projectile vomiting
totally.
All over their living room.
Yep. Thank God it was hardwood floor.
Oh my gosh.
The dog starts licking it. They have to take the dog outside.
Oh,
yes. Yes. It was so bad. So anyway, to make a long story short, she's such a cool girl. Like, she was so relaxed about it. Like I would have been like, oh my God. You
oh
know?
My gosh.
She was great. So yeah, that's my Sandy. Now I'm like, I still have like PTSD from the vomit. But overall, it was a really great week.
Now, aren't you getting a bit desensitized with your kids?
That's
to
the great thing. My friend
aversion?
Said to me, she knows my fear. She's like, I'm so impressed. You're so calm. And I'm like, you know what? When like in crisis, like when things happen, I'm actually really good. It's almost like the anticipatory, like, is he going to vomit? Is he? And I didn't know he was going to. So it's like during the moment, I'm okay. But yes, it's definitely helping. I think God's like, look, you were in a safe environment. You had your parents. You had a good friend. Like, let me just throw it on you when you're the most safe.
Oh, my
so
gosh.
So that's how I saw
you
it.
Poor thing.
I know.
Okay, on a brighter note, though, your kids are better.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Good.
And the other one did not catch.
Thank God. I'm not going to jinx anything, but all good in the hood, okay. As far as I know.
What did you and David do when you were in San Diego?
Oh, it was so great. We stayed at Mission Bay. They have this like beautiful bay and
it's
resort.
So pretty there.
Oh my God. So I don't know. We didn't even do that much. We took a walk. We relaxed. We went to the beach. We took a lot of photos. He's big into like sunsets and things. So we did that. I mean, it was super relaxed. He took a nap. Like he's like never takes a nap, but he was so tired. So it was really, really nice. I had a great time. Yeah.
That's wonderful.
And then my dog celebrated his 10th birthday. We bought him a dog cake.
Woohoo! And happy birthday, Moose.
So it was a good week. It really was.
That's so
How
fun.
How about you?
Well, you know, it was really fun because my daughter had this really cool girlfriend during high school, one of her best friends.
Yeah.
And we just stayed really close with her. So she just graduated college at the U of Oregon, University of Oregon. And so she was down and she got a job at the La Brea Tar Pits. She's actually handling fossils and doing all the stuff. She's an archaeologist now.
Oh, so cool.
So cool. So she came over for dinner and she was telling us all about that. It was just very special. And my daughter's like, because she's not around. She's like, there's something not right about this. You're having dinner with one of my best friends.
That's so sweet.
So cool. So that was fun. But you know, something interesting So you know we're going off to Alaska.
Yes.
And I'm so excited about it. But you would like to think that if you called the cruise ship and you asked them, what is your under-the-bed storage like, right?
Yes.
Because cabins, we're not getting a suite or anything like that.
Small.
It could be very small.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of closet space. There's not a lot of space to even walk around the cabin. So because they have the beds, sometimes, you know, you'd want to know, can you fit suitcases?
Sure.
Talk to everybody we could imagine at the cruise ship.
No one knows.
You know, on every level, nobody knows the dimensions underneath the bed.
Wow. That's really interesting.
But they come back and they say, well, my friends put their suitcases under there, so I'm assuming it's okay. But, oh my gosh. Do you know what the spinners are?
No.
I just got new suitcases. They're on
they're
on four or eight wheels. So you just glide them and push them. You don't have to break your back.
Yes.
So excited.
So amazing. I'm excited for your trip. Put me in that suitcase and hide me from my kids.
Well, we have a fantastic show today. We got to recap last week's show. If you just tuned in, you are listening to Dr. Deborah and Coach Kelly. And if you do want to give us a call, please do so at 323-203-0815, 323-203-0815, and keep those emails coming. We have some great ones for today. So last week we had Carrie Hannon, who wrote the book Love Your Job, The New Rules for Career Happiness.
Mm-hmm.
She writes columns. She was a really good guest. I thought she was really informative. She talked to us about the hover method, which you imply to have hope, optimism, value, enthusiasm, and resilience. And what I love the most about what she talked about was the concept of becoming an entrepreneur even while you're in your own job.
I like that too.
You know, that you are looking at your job as your client.
Exactly. Yeah, and just taking it very seriously. And yeah, I thought she had really, really great advice as far as, especially with people if they're miserable in their jobs and how to take those small steps forward, you know, into another job or a different passion. And it doesn't have to be so black or white, like I'm not doing my passion and I hate my job. You know, there's a middle ground is kind of what I was really hearing from her, which was nice.
I also liked what she said, which was, without saying it, and these are my words, is that you've got to break through your own level of entitlement. Some people feel entitled to, this is my dream and this is what I want. I ought to have it right now. And they don't see that they need to do the work or maybe take the steps on the side. Sometimes you have to sort of bear being in a job you don't like so much. Find something that you can like about it.
Yes.
Change your perspective about it. But then work on building up your momentum to do other things. But this idea that some people just say, well, I'm just going to quit that job and my dream job's going to come.
Uh-huh.
And then they're poor and impoverished. They've failed on responsibility. So that whole sense of entitlement, I think people need to really watch out for, because you know what? Why are we entitled to something? We get entitled to something because we put hard work into it.
So true. You're right. I forgot about that part of it. You're right. She was a real, like a realist in that way. I really like that too.
Well, with all of her finance background as
well. Yes, exactly. Super helpful with that. Very knowledgeable. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you missed last week's show, make sure you go to LA Talk Radio website and take a look at it, and you can listen anytime.
Right. We have a super special guest today. I am so excited to introduce Dr. Dan Politz. He is a sex therapist, and he's a licensed psychologist with over 30 years of clinical experience. He received his doctorate in psychology from Boston University. He worked as senior staff psychologist in the Department of Rehabilitation Psychology and in the Department of Urology at Boston Medical Center. He's a certified sex therapist. He's trained in emotional-focused couples therapy called EFT, and more recently in internal family systems, IFS. He's currently in private practice in Medford, Massachusetts. Welcome, Dr. P.
Thank you for having me. It's a privilege to be on your show.
We're super, super excited. We have so many questions for you.
Well, but first, when people in this office talk about how many steps they've taken, they're really talking about AA. So I was
about the Fitbit, exactly. That's funny.
A little recovery joke there.
I like that.
That is so funny.
And I'm sorry, I forgot to read the second part of it about your, we can do that also at the end, about your, you have a psychology blog, Psychology Today blog on your website, right, called Mindful Sex. I just want to make sure that our listeners are, okay, perfect.
I do.
And that's available at your website, which is drdanpolitz.com. Is that right? Or
exactly.
Okay, perfect. Okay.
Yeah, well, welcome to our show. Is there something you want to just tell us about you before we even bombard you with all these questions? Something that I see that you're into mindfulness and all that. And how does that all play about in sex therapy?
Well, you know, I have the kind of therapy I do is about using the experience, the expertise of my own experience as it is, the technical and intellectual knowledge I've gathered on my journey. Psychology has always been a place where I could both discover my own parts and resolve my conflicts, as well as kind of learn how to help people and learn about personality and how it affects living in this world. So I just kind of follow my interests, and luckily I've had that kind of ability and, you know, great blessing to find something early in my life that I love to do. So I think it's a great career.
It's so interesting. People must constantly ask questions. Like, just normal people, when you tell them you're a sex therapist, I can only imagine the questions that they ask you all the time. Now, what makes...
Well, you had a question about that in this, the questionnaire you sent me.
Yeah. What are the... Well, yeah. Were you talking about the top misconceptions when it comes to sex and relationships?
Yeah. Well, no. You the question about, like, what people... When people... How people... When they find out when you're a sex therapist, but how do they respond? It's pretty funny, actually. I look kind of normal, but they're pretty amazed that someone who looks sort of normal is actually doing that. They're usually, like, at a cocktail party or something, there's this, like, pregnant pause, they shuffle, there's some twitching, and then there's this awkward, embarrassed silence, and then they slowly slink away.
Oh my! Really?
As if I'm like in a thread to expose some secret.
That's like you could read their mind. Like they suddenly have all these questions.
There's a show, Masters of Sex. I don't know if you're
watching that show.
Showtime, but I think they when they hear like some of the sex therapists, people think that I'm actually watching people having sex. Which I assure them I'm not. I'm just listening.
Well, that, you know, there is there are people out there that are certified sex surrogates, right? And those are people who actually either have sex with people. That's
really
not the same as a sex therapist. So maybe you could actually give our listeners some idea about what that, with the difference between those two.
If you know what that is, yeah, I don't.
Well, sex surrogates, the Association of Sex Therapists, Counselors, and Educators, which is a major credentialing organization for sex therapists, it's not so ethical to prescribe surrogates. I mean, there's so many problems that when you kind of get people involved in with sexual surrogates, it's not ethical in terms of the American Psychological Association. So, I mean, it's sort of out of your hands to prescribe that, but people do, I guess, people who will work. There was a great movie with Helen Hunt a few years ago where she was a sexual surrogate in California. Where else? And she was hired to work with this disabled quadriplegic who had lost the ability to have have function in his body, and she was hired by him to provide him with an experience of sexuality, him having lost the ability to be able to find somebody. So, but it doesn't really exist in Boston, which tends to be conservative. Basically, I try to work with couples, whereas the partners provide the sex, surrogacy
to each other.
With each other.
That makes sense. So, okay, so, yeah, I wanted to know about the top misconceptions when it comes to sex and relationships.
I thought long and hard about this. I kind of wrote a few. I tell you what, I'll go through a bunch, and then you tell me which one you want to focus on.
Sure,
right,
sounds
good.
Perfect.
Okay? Okay, here's a misconception. Long-term relationships mean boring sex. Number two, you should feel in love with your partner all the time. Three, there's something called your soulmate out there, if you could just find him or her. Four, relationships should be easy and natural, and when they're not, there's something seriously wrong, and you should go out and get a new partner. Five, the power and passion of the honeymoon period with all the awesome chemistry should not change, and it's a tragedy when it does. And six, finding the right mate is simply a matter of matching levels of attraction or compatibility or personality or timing.
First of all, those were fabulous.
Yeah,
I want to know about all of them, but I know we don't have time. But what was your top, Dr. Deborah? Because I'll tell you mine.
I can't pick. Do I have to pick? Do I have to, mommy? Do I have to pick?
Number five about the passion, because I can't even tell you. I know someone in particular. I don't want to out this person, but it's a guy, and he's constantly saying to me, like, well, you know, he'll be in, like, long-term relationships, and he'll say to me, like, well, the passion's not the same, like, as when we were first dating, and it's, you know, it's, and I say to him, it's going to be different. I mean, there's that newness when you first meet somebody. You don't have that, the connection. You don't have that intimacy, but yeah, I want to hear from you, Dr. P, your thoughts around that. It's a great, great misconception.
Well, I don't know if you've ever read the work of Helen Fisher, who's a famous sexual anthropologist. I think she's at I don't know if it's NYU. I think it's a college up the road from NYU. The name of it escapes me. But anyway, she has dedicated her career to investigating the chemistry of love and attraction. And she actually, I guess, is a paid consultant to Match.com. So she talks a lot about, like, she puts people under functional MRIs and explores the brain, their neuropsychology when they're in love. And she's kind of found that, you know, the chemicals of that early period, the honeymoon period of attraction, is like as powerful as cocaine, and it kind of, there's a dopamine is a neurotransmitter which is associated with pleasure, and that there's profound dumping of dopamine when you meet someone and you have that intense chemistry, and there's dopamine, and there's oxytocin, and there's these neurotransmitters that get secreted by the brain that evoke this really powerful experience of passion and love, and that's sort of an effect that just happens over a short period of time. Also, and that's Terry Real, who's a teacher of mine. He talked about that early stage of relationship as love without knowledge, and then ultimately love without knowledge slowly transforms into love with knowledge. And there you go. You have to kind of deal with imperfections, and those chemicals are not being evoked as they once were, and you're sort of there realizing you don't have your redeemer in front of you. You have someone who's as imperfect as you. Right. Now, people who have, you know, a certain style of attachment would then feel, okay, this is not working for me, and then create some kind of conflict so they can leave the relationship.
I see.
So those who have good attachment, you have secure attachment, who've been well taken care of through their life, then would realize, well, this is just love, and relationship is like life. It is always changing. And if you try to hold on, this brings us into the whole topic of mindfulness. Because relationship, like life, like anything, if you try to hold on and attach yourself and hope things don't change, you end up suffering. And people who can't accept that relationships and love is a transformative experience through daily have a very hard time in relationships.
So. Yeah, and that's also, in my experience, particularly difficult for people who have endured abuse in childhood to be able to distinguish in a real relationship whether, when things start to go bad, is it in that same category of abuse? And then they have been taught, you know, a healthy person would run for the hills, as opposed to being able to distinguish and fine-tune what's really abuse and what's just,
conflict.
You know what, this is just a challenging situation with two different personalities, people trying to achieve the same goal but going about it differently.
Yes, that makes sense. Yeah, wow.
You know, Dan, I had a saying that I use with couples a lot that I say, couples who play together, stay together. Oh. And that's because I think some of the research also shows, maybe you can help me with this, that there is also some of those chemicals that when two people are enjoying a similar thing together, uh-huh. that they end up reporting greater feelings of love afterwards because of having that shared experience with one another. Does the research support that in any way?
Having like shared activities, and right there's these two separate individual, like in healthy secure attachment, mm-hmm. it's like there's two individuated autonomous individuals who have a whole range of interests, and they come together. There's chemistry, there's attraction, there's compatibility, and then there's sort of an overlap. But yet there's parts that stay separate, right? Like my wife, who I love dearly, and has a whole bunch of interests mm-hmm. that I'm not all that interested in, and then I have all these interests that she's not interested in. But we have a whole bunch that overlap, and we enjoy doing. Mm-hmm. And it really doesn't matter what we're doing; it's more like being together. That's the most important thing. So, like I would think if you were trying to find someone who equally matches every aspect of your interest, then that's going to be very hard to find.
Sure.
In fact, I think as relationship age and people kind of the relationship transforms from that early period of intensity to more love with knowledge, people tend to kind of need more space and kind of go off and want to feel that they can. It's like a child who is this, like a 2-year-old going off and practicing and coming back to mommy and mm-hmm. feeling that they're securely attached. You have a secure attachment. You also want to be able to kind of go out and explore the world
sure.
and gratify your own interests, as well as know you could come back home and feel there's a warm body there welcoming you.
That's so true.
Yeah, that's always fun to go off and enjoy something, be able to come back and share it with
sure.
your partner and have your partner
yeah.
excited about
exactly.
it, as opposed to feel threatened or
yes.
anxious that you had a good time without him or her.
Sure.
Now, that's always been a challenge for so many people
yeah.
to not be insecure and feel threatened. And you do talk a lot, Dr. P, about secure attachment, but I just find that so many people don't have secure attachments. So you have any advice for people mm-hmm. in those situations? So let's say one or the other is more insecure than, let's say the wife is much more insecure than the
yeah.
husband. The husband likes to go off and play golf and do these things, and
sure.
then the wife starts to experience, uh-oh, he's going to leave me for something,
yeah.
you know,
mm-hmm.
or he's either going to cheat on me or he's not really going to play golf. It just starts up with all that noise in her head and then takes it into
yeah.
the relationship. What would you recommend that he do in that situation?
I don't know if you've run across this book called Being Attached. I can't remember the authors, but there's a there was a book written not too long ago
okay.
about with these researchers who have used attachment theory, which is really hot and heavy in psychology,
yeah.
to write a guide for those who are searching for relationships. But it's useful common sense approach to sort of understanding your own attachment style, and your attachment style. And this is serious research fact information. There's like secure attachment where like the default option is that you trust that people are there for you and that you're worth it,
mm-hmm.
and you don't fret and feel threatened. And there's an anxious attachment style, which you never quite get enough. You're always kind of fearful of abandonment, that you need a lot of assurance and reinforcement and acknowledgement. And when you don't get that, you start worrying about the relationship. Then there's a style called avoidant attachment mm-hmm. style, where there's like a threat of being smothered, and when you get too much, you're going to be uh-huh. overcome with the intimacy. So you, like guys, typically guys, I guess, but
mm-hmm.
women as well, can feel that their selves are going to be overcome and smothered, so they turn away from relationship and head to the hills
mm-hmm.
when intimacy threatens. And then there's a very problematic attachment style called anxious avoidant, which is usually the case when people have trauma, early
yes.
childhood trauma. So, I mean, if if you could kind of nail your own attachment style and try to get explore it, get help for it, learn about your parts, you know, in IFS language.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
There's a whole literature about how different styles match up. Like I tend to be more of the anxious attached, and so I need someone who's secure and a bit more anxious themselves, so I can kind of feel that I'm getting enough. So when I dated long ago, and I was with someone who was more avoidant, you know, in other words, like you would call them and they would never call back for 30 days. Like that, just that didn't work for me. I need someone who was like totally there, giving me a response to my inquiry.
Sure.
You know, I'll speak to that too, because historically in my relationships when I was much younger, I mean, I had radar for the avoidant attachment, being the anxious one. It was like I thought it was my own AA, anxious and avoidant have to go together. I mean, it was just profound how many of those dudes I would find myself attached to, attracted to, who, you know, they start the whole mix with, oh my God, I love you so much. They talk about that in the first 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and then they hook you in, and then 3 days later, it's like you can't find them. You send them a message. It's like you said, 3 days, and they, what's up with that? And talk about taking that anxious attachment and just like blowing it up to like bitty pieces where I just thought I was like falling apart in hysteria, you know. Now finally with Christopher, it's so nice because I think he actually craves being around me more than I even crave being around him. So I get to be the one who's like, okay, back off,
buddy. Like,
back
off just a little bit. Sure.
I need a little space, which is so unusual for me to be asking for some space, you know. How about you? What do you think historically
I'm thinking about that. You know, I feel like over the years I've definitely become just more secure, but I think it's because I'm like happier with who I am and more confident and things like that. But I feel like in my 20s I was definitely much more anxious and, you know, that kind of thing, because I just wasn't comfortable with me. But I don't know if they're related, but that's kind of how I see it. So I don't know.
You also have such a stable guy.
He's fantastic. David, he's
like,
really great.
You could just count on him.
I'm definitely the more flirt in the relationship, for sure. Like, I feel like I can't even imagine him like flirting with anybody. Like, I maybe that's part of it. I don't worry at all about him. I feel bad for him because I'm more of the friendly, you know, flirty one. But, you know, so I don't know. So it is good. So I feel grateful.
Hey, one more thing, ladies. History is not destiny with these attachment styles. You can in the context of a good therapeutic relationship or some kind of relationship, you can become more secure. Everything's on a spectrum. So if you have, you know, if you've had the unfortunate historical fact of being in a family where you didn't get your early needs met, you know, there's still hope, like creating a relationship in which you can feel trust, feel safe, and through the talking about what happened and accessing these parts of you that were damaged, wounded, in IFS they're called exile parts, you can transform personality and have more of a kind of healthy, functional adult self available that can be then more relational and more securely attached. So these things, our brains are resilient. We're social, relational beings. We have resilient brains. But, you know, as relationships kind of make us hurt us, relationships can make us well. So
it makes sense.
You know,
for sure.
I'm in that kind of business of helping people recover and transform their parts that were wounded,
right?
Because you know, the whatever the accident of birth.
Sure,
Absolutely. Yeah, that's such a good message for everybody to remember that healing is almost always possible, right?
It's
if somebody wants it, it's available.
Yes.
It's just about finding the resources and and going after them.
And being patient.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Dr. Debra and Coach Kelly, and our phone number is 323-203-0815. We have a great guest today, Dr. Dan Politz, also known as Dr. P, who's a sex therapist, talking to us about mindfulness and about relationships and about attachment, secure attachment. And we got to go back to some of those top misconceptions.
No, but I have so many more questions.
I do too.
Oh, my God.
Okay. And we have to get to pornography.
Bring them on.
Well, that's maybe we should talk a little bit about pornography, because I feel like that is something that I would like to get into too. Or do you want to finish the misconceptions, or what do you want to do?
Pornography. Okay. I think we need to talk
all
about
right.
that, because that is like number one
yes.
biggest problem that I'm seeing in couples
yes.
these days, and in young couples. You know, it's like, I mean, mm-hmm. I've heard young women, their attitude is, well, of course he does porn. What guy doesn't?
Exactly.
Like it's so mainstream
it
in
is
their
mainstream.
Lives. And I'll say, well, how do you feel about it? Say, I feel kind of crappy about it, and I don't want to have sex with him a lot of the times just because I know he's doing that.
Right.
But it's like, it's almost like, well, it's just there. It's like,
right.
you know, it's like a pair of shoes.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. What are your thoughts, Dr.
Us.
P? We want to hear everything.
Do you want me to? Do you have any specific?
There's this
2014 article, The Archives of Sexual Behavior, which discussed how for men, there was like 500 men who were inquired as to their pornography, and then they assessed how their own sexual attitudes play out in their relationships, and they found that there are very profound negative implications impact.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very negative impact on, and it's kind of a correlation between how much pornography is watched and men's expectations and behaviors during sexual encounters. And that has been my anecdotal clinical impression, as well as my reading of the literature.
Okay, so now let's say that a couple was having some issues, and they said, well, it does help us, you know, as a couple to watch porn. Would you, you know, encourage that, or you feel like, no, you're going down the wrong path?
Well, if it's pornography in the service of a shared sexual enhancement mm-hmm. experience, and no one is objecting, and everyone is happy,
yeah.
then who am I to say this is I'm not going to judge better or moralistic.
Right.
And that would not be a clinical case. They would not be sitting in front of me.
True.
Saying that wouldn't be the issue.
Yeah.
If what the problem comes because, you know, one of the people, usually the man, is secretly indulging
yeah.
in a compulsive behavior mm-hmm. which is changing his brain as well as creating a dysfunctional relational experience.
Yeah.
And there's both neuropsychological or there's a brain chemistry about addiction and pornography that alters one's sensitization in sexual sensation as well as change the bar as far as what you feel arousing.
Yeah.
So if you're steeped and you're stewing mm-hmm. in these highly provocative images on a daily, mostly daily basis, and you're masturbating to these images, then when you have a real life, real time, imperfect partner that you're expected to make love to, it palls in comparison to these images.
Yeah.
And a lot of these guys come in and they're having erectile dysfunction, they're not, mm-hmm. their desire is off, they're avoiding mm-hmm. sex, and they can't do intimacy anymore. So the wife drags him in and says, oh, I discovered that he had this whole trove of pornography, and it was like horrifying, and I felt traumatized by the fact that this whole secret life was going on.
Yeah.
And then he could come pouring out as to how much time. I had a man last year, 3 months ago, 6 months ago. he was a attorney in a very prestigious law firm in Boston. And he had came in and he had gotten fired because his pornography compulsion has reached the level where he was viewing it at work.
Oh my!
And so about it, and he was gone in a New York minute.
Wow.
I mean, done. But he had like this big house in Wellesley and two kids and this wife who was also an attorney.
Wow.
And in one second, this career that he had worked towards all his life.
Yeah.
And
it's just gone.
So much shame. There was so much shame about this that he couldn't, you know, like 6 months later, he still hadn't told his parents that he had gotten fired from his job. Very big. So things can rapidly escalate. Pornography, compulsive behavior. And this is not your daddy's pornography.
Right.
Your brain is being subject to multiple images flashing by your brain that create, like, remember this neurotransmitter dopamine that evokes dopamine and gets you these pleasure centers all stoked up and you're going to masturbate, highly reinforcing. And it's relieving, it feels good. And sooner or later, like, it starts occupying a bigger and larger part of your life to the extent that you can't turn away, you're dependent on it, and ultimately it starts affecting your functioning and your relationship.
So
it's desensitizing. It perpetuates a view of women as submissive, and it objectifies women. And again, I don't want to be moralistic. This is not all the time, everything. This is when it reaches the level where it's compulsive and addicting.
But even in much milder situations where people will just occasionally use porn, I've seen it affect couples in really damaging ways. Even when she knows and he says, well, basically, you know, I just use it on occasion because you don't want to have sex or you're going through that time of the month. And, and you know, and even would say that they could stop at any time and it doesn't affect them. I still can hear in the way they talk about sex and you can almost see it in their eyes.
You can see the change.
Yeah, that they actually, it does affect them. Even though they might deny it or be unwilling to acknowledge that.
You're the one member who got me, my eyes really opened on how it can really, really affect relationships. Because remember, you know, we had one caller who called in and I was like, oh, you know, it's okay. You know, especially I saw it more as an enhancement in the couple, but you really opened my eyes to kind of how damaging it can be. And
it's really how it affects the brain. And as Dr. P is describing, and I've seen this to be so true, it's that you don't even, it's so insidious. It happens so quickly. And it's just kind of like changing the way you perceive a healthy romantic intimate moment.
It's
just because, you know, it's like the difference between if you just had a whole night out on cocaine all night long,
And
then the next day you're asked to go sit and go watch a boring movie.
Yeah,
but somebody's like, whoa, let me pick which one. And you do that all the time.
Yeah.
You know, it's very much similar to that.
That makes sense. Well, I want to know, how do you treat an addiction with pornography? Is it cold turkey? I mean, is there like a 12-step program? Like, what do you typically recommend for your clients if they have an addiction?
Can I just make one comment before I... So we talked about like people who have more of an anxious attachment. But you can imagine that someone who has that attachment style and is a bit more insecure about the relationship and finds out that their husband... has this whole relationship with this these images that have been that he's been spending a hell of a lot more time masturbating to these images instead of being available and being present and for a kind of intimacy and sexual relationship with her. And like the spouse will come in and shocked and fear and worried and anxiety and insecurity. And the pornography, I think this is Deborah was saying, like it poses a threat.
Yeah.
Like in attachment, in EFT, emotionally focused couples therapy, we call them attachment injuries.
Well, like it's
an attachment injury that your partner is, you know, has this trove of pornography that he's been watching, you know, daily and masturbating to. So the people who find me and I treat, that it's always, it's a threat, it's an attachment injury, it increases insecurity and it decreases trust.
Yeah.
And also, like, you think about it, right, I don't agree that you can enhance your sexual relationship. You know, we talk about mindful sex. I don't know if I'm going to be able to talk about that, but kind of mindfulness is about being present, being where you are, being here and now in a kind of in a non-judgmental way. So when you're engaging in this present moment, sensational, wonderful experience called intimacy, what you want your awareness focus on the sensations that are coming from your body, like being feeling these sensations as you listen and feel the sensations that you're creating in your partner. And this kind of present moment evolvement of this process of increasing arousal as your own arousal is increased is called making love. Right, you have to, your awareness cannot be out there. It has to be on these cues that are in the moment, in your body, in your perception of your partner's body. So what I think good sex is really about helping people develop the awareness to be present in their body as they are empathically attuned with their partner's arousal signs. And there's this dance, this lovely dance that you could slow down and you could speed up and you can involve all sorts of body parts and all sorts of ways of stimulation as you do this dance in whatever room of the house, whatever hotel you find yourself. And in so doing, like, always creating innovation as it is coming home. Right, like, so you're coming home to this wonderful place, but you're also able to create innovation and experimentation, which keeps the relationship and sexuality new and exciting. You can't do that when your brain has been conditioned to these images, you know, on this two-dimensional computer that you're watching.
Sure. Tragically, so many of these situations, it feels like an infidelity. It doesn't even just feel like, okay, my husband was jerking off to something.
Exactly.
It wasn't me. It's like,
it feels betrayal.
Almost as bad, if not even worse sometimes, because it's there. She is a real person there. And
exactly.
Why was he not interested in at least pursuing more of that with her? But I also found that for many people who have gone down the spectrum of addiction in sex addiction, porn addiction, that they're not able to be mindful at the start at all.
Yeah.
Like there's got so much more training that has to occur. And do you find that too, Dr. P? I mean, it's like they can't just start out mindful. So do you have some steps or...
No, no. Well, mindfulness is a capacity of the mind that's cultivated. Like you go to the gym, I know you're in your workout clothes while you go to the gym. you're there to practice, you know, you're exercising, you go and you practice working out. So you're not just there to have a great time for that one time. You're there to do this thing called exercise that you slow, that you increase, so that your baseline level of fitness improves as you practice. So mindfulness is cultivated. It's a capacity of the frontal cortex where these higher cortical functions exist in this front part of your brain that you can exercise, like you exercise your muscles by meditation or other mindfulness awareness practices such as Tai Chi, yoga, Qigong, all sorts of insight meditation. So there's all these ways that you can stoke, you can evoke, you can stimulate these neurons in this part of your brain, the ultimate result of which is to have this capacity for awareness that is present moment, that is non-judgmental in the moment. So what I do is, like, I teach people what mindfulness is. And then if they're willing, I teach them a simple meditation.
Cool.
Exercise and or to talk about yoga, and so they can practice learning how to be more present by sitting in a meditation. Not everyone buys that, and you can certainly talk about mindfulness and teach people about mindfulness without people learning how to meditate.
So
seems like there's also so much that needs to be done too about shame, healing shame, and learning how to self-soothe, that those all together are so important when somebody's trying to overcome these kinds of addictions, because they're tough. I mean, I worked with a couple where she discovered that he had oh my God, so many multiple affairs and pornography addiction and all this. And when she uncovered all this, and he would go into treatment and then he would relapse and she would find it again. And to the point where she was so wounded and beaten down by, even after like a year of his own individual therapy and their couples therapy, he was just so close to always relapsing. He was doing these things, but it had gotten so severe that it just, she couldn't feel that trust.
Yeah, sure.
It was sad. So sad. But we are actually running out of time.
Get out of here.
Yeah.
Dr. Fee, you are so amazing. Thank you so much for all your insight and wisdom. And I really do love the whole notion of this mindfulness during sex. And I'm gonna preach it to my clients as well, because I think it's very true. And I think it's really overlooked. I was listening to Dr. Ruth the other day, and she was talking about, it's okay if you fantasize about a whole football team. She was like joking with it. But, I think there's something to be said about really being present with your partner and all of that. So I think that was really, really great advice and insight.
Thank you. Anyone last question or comment? Or?
Well, we want people to know how to find you. So let's give your website out again, which is www.drdanpollitz.com.
People can write me. It's danpollitz @gmail.com. drdanpollitz@gmail.com. If they want to write me, I'll be happy to respond.
Okay,
wonderful.
It's Polletts. Just for
I never got to answer your question about how to treat addiction, but maybe at another show sometime.
Absolutely.
there's all sorts of interventions and with synchronous with how extreme their addiction or compulsion is.
Sure.
So you match the therapy with how problematic or dysfunctional the compulsion is.
Absolutely, and that's a show all on its own. So we'll happily have you on again to dive into that one, because it is a major problem out there, that is for sure.
Patrick Carnes. People can look up Patrick Carnes, who's sort of the godfather of sexual addiction, a wonderful man, and he's at the Meadows in Arizona, but he has many, many lectures on YouTube about sexual addiction, and he believes it's sort of like a number one health crisis in the next 10 years. And you could see, like, watching all these kids addicted to their mobile phone.
Right.
What do you think they're doing when they get home at night?
Right.
So this is a serious problem.
Thank you, Dr. Pollitz. We are so grateful to have had you on our show.
Yes, thank you.
You have
so
a great
much.
Day. And Kelly, where can people find you?
So you can find me at www.kellymiller.com. And my book is Professor Kelly's Guide to Finding a Husband. You can find it on Amazon. We also have our website, which is talkitoutradio.com, which is great, and you can find all of our archive shows there as well. Where can I find you?
You know what? Before we do that, I just forgot to mention that we have a great guest next week as well, Dr. Erica Scott, who is a world-renowned art therapist and addiction specialist, and she's going to help us understand how to use art therapy with people who have suffered trauma, and she's really a gem. She's got a lot of great information. And you can find me at drdebraonline.com, drdebraonline.com. Okay, so have a great day, and until next time.
See you then. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.